nectar of the requiem trees. In the dark of the grove, their eyes shone silver like the mosaics of the temple roof. Madrigal reached the ground, and Akiva landed beside her in a gust of warmth. She faced him. They were still wearing their masks. They could have stripped them off while flying, but they hadn't. Madrigal had been thinking of this moment, when they would stand face to face, and she had left her mask on because in her imagining, it was Akiva who took hers off, as she did his. He must have imagined the same thing. He stepped toward her. The real world, already a distant thing, just a crackle of fireworks at horizon's edge, faded away entirely. A high, sweet thrill sang through Madrigal, as if she were a lute string. Akiva took off his gloves and dropped them, and when he touched her, fingertips trailing up her arms and neck, it was with his bare hands. He reached behind her head, untied her mask, and lifted it away. Her vision, which had been narrowed all night to what she could see through its small apertures, opened, and Akiva filled her sight, still wearing his comical mask. She heard his soft exhalation and murmur of, "So beautiful." And she reached up and took off his disguise. "Hello," she whispered, as she had when they had come together in the Emberlin, and happiness had bloomed in her. That happiness was like a spark to a firework compared with what filled her now. He was more perfect even than she remembered. At Bullfinch he had lain dying, ashen, slack, and still beautiful for all that. Now, in the full flush of health and the blood thrum of love, he was golden. He was ardent, gazing at her, hopeful and expectant, inspired, beguiled, glad. He was so alive. Because of her, he was alive. He whispered back, "Hello." They stared, amazed to be facing each other after 2 years, as if they were figments conjured out of wishing. Only touching could make the moment real. Madrigal's hands shook as she raised them, and steadied when she laid them against the solidity of Akiva's chest. Heat pulsed through the fabric of his shirt. The air in the grove was rich enough to sip, full enough to dance with. It was like a presence between them. And then not, as she stepped close. His arms encircled her, and she tilted up her face to whisper once more, "Hello." This time, when he said it back, he breathed it against her lips. Their eyes were still open, still wide with wonder, and they only let them flutter shut when their lips finally met, and another sense, touch, could take over in convincing them that this was real. Chapter 56. The Invention of Living. Once upon a time, there was only darkness, and there were monsters vast as worlds who swam in it. They were the Gibborum, and they loved the darkness because it concealed their hideousness. Whenever some other creature contrived to make light, they would extinguish it. When stars were born, they swallowed them, and it seemed that darkness would be eternal. But a race of bright warriors heard of the Gibborum and traveled from their far world to do battle with them. The war was long, light against dark, and many of the warriors were slain. In the end, when they vanquished the monsters, there were 100 left alive, and these 100 were the God Stars, who brought light to the universe. They made the rest of the stars, including our sun, and there was no more darkness, only endless light. They made children in their image, seraphim, and sent them down to bear light to the worlds that spun in space, and all was good. But one day, the last of the Geborim, who was called Zanzumin, persuaded them that shadows were needed, that they would make the light seem brighter by contrast. And so the god stars brought shadows into being. But Zanzumin was a trickster. He needed only a shred of darkness to work with. He breathed life into the shadows. And as the god stars had made the seraphim in their own image, so did Zanzumin make the chimera in his. And so they were hideous. And forever after, the seraphim would fight on the side of light, and chimera for dark. And they would be enemies until the end of the world. Madrigal laughed sleepily. Zanzumin? That's a name?
Don't ask me, he's your forefather.
Ah, yes, ugly Uncle Zanzumin, who made me out of a shadow.
A hideous shadow, said Akiva, which explains your hideousness.
She laughed again, heavy and lazy with pleasure. I always wondered where I got it. Now I know. My horns are from my father's side, and my hideousness is from my huge, evil monster uncle. After a pause, Akiva, nuzzling her neck, she added, I like my story better. I'd rather be made from tears than darkness.
Neither is very cheerful, said Akiva.
I know. We need a happier myth. Let's make one up. They lay entwined atop their clothes, which they had draped over a bank of shrive moss behind Eli's temple, where a delicate rill burbled past. Both moons had slipped beyond the canopy of the trees, and the evangelines were falling silent as the requiem blooms closed their white buds for the night. Soon Madrigal would have to leave, but they were both pushing the thought away, as if they could deny the dawn. Once upon a time, said Akiva, but his voice trailed off as his lips found Madrigal's throat. Sugar. I thought I got it all. Now I'll have to double-check everywhere. Madrigal squirmed, laughing helplessly. No, it tickles! But Akiva would retaste her neck, and it didn't really tickle so much as it tingled, and she stopped protesting soon enough. It was some time before they got back around to their new myth. Once upon a time, Madrigal murmured later, her face now resting on Akiva's chest so that the curve of her left horn followed the line of his face, and he could tilt his brow against it. There was a world that was perfectly made and full of birds and striped creatures and lovely things like honey lilies and star tenzing and weasels.
Weasels?
Hush. And this world already had light and shadow, so it didn't need any rogue stars to come and save it, and it had no use for bleeding suns or weeping moons either. And most important, it had never known war, which is a terrible, wasteful thing that no world ever needs. It had earth and water, air and fire, all four elements. But it was missing the last element. Love. Akiva's eyes were closed. He smiled as he listened and stroked the soft down of Madrigal's fur-short hair and traced the ridges of her horns. And so this paradise was like a jewel box without a jewel. There it lay, day after day of rose-colored dawns and creature sounds and strange perfumes, and waited for lovers to find it and fill it with their happiness. Pause. The end.
The end? Akiva opened his eyes. What do you mean, the end?
She said, smoothing her cheek against the golden skin of his chest. The story's unfinished. The world is still waiting. He said wistfully,
Do you know how to find it? Let's leave before the sun rises.
The sun.
The reminder stilled Madrigal's lips from their new course up the curve of Akiva's shoulder, the one scarred with the reminder of their first meeting at Bullfinch. She thought how she might have left him bleeding, or worse, finished him. But some ineluctable thing had stopped her so that they might be here now, and the idea of disentangling, dressing, leaving, gave rise to a reluctance so powerful it hurt. There was dread, too, of what her disappearance might have stirred up back in Loramendi. An image of Thiago, angry, intruded into her happiness, and she pushed it away. But there was no pushing away the sunrise. In a mournful voice she said, "I have to go." Akiva said, "I know." And she lifted her face from his shoulder and saw that his wretchedness matched her own. He didn't ask, "What will we do?" And she didn't either. Later they would talk of such things. On that first night they were shy of the future and, for all that they had loved and discovered in the night, still shy of each other. Instead, Madrigal reached up for the charm she wore around her neck. "Do you know what this is?" she asked him, untying the cord.
"A bone?"
"Well, yes. It's a wishbone. You hook your finger around the spur, like this, and we each make a wish and pull. Whoever gets the bigger piece gets their wish."
"Magic?" Akiva asked, sitting up. "What bird does this come from, that its bones make magic?"
"Oh, it's not magic. The wishes don't really come true."
"Then why do it?"
She shrugged. "Hope? Hope can be a powerful force. Maybe there's no actual magic in it, but when you know what you hope for most and hold it like a light within you, you can make things happen. Almost like magic."
"And what do you hope for most?"
"You're not supposed to tell. Come, wish with me." She held up the wishbone. It was part whimsy and part impudence that had made her put the thing on a cord. She had been 14, 4 years in Brimstone's service, and now in battle training and feeling full of her own power. She'd come into the shop one afternoon while Twiga was plucking newly minted lucknows from their molds, and she had wheedled for one. Brimstone had not yet educated her about the harsh reality of magic and the pain tithe, and she still regarded wishing as fun. When he refused her, as he always did, not counting Scuppies, which cost a mere pinch of pain to create, she'd had a small, dramatic meltdown in the corner. She couldn't even remember now what wish had been of such dire importance to her 14-year-old self, but she well remembered Issa extracting a bone from the remains of the evening meal, a grim grouse in sauce, and comforting her with the human lore of the wishbone. Issa had a wealth of human stories, and it was from her that Madrigal came by her fascination with that race and their world. In defiance of Brimstone, she took the bone and made an elaborate show of wishing on it.
"That's it?"
Brimstone asked when he heard what petty desire had inspired her tantrum.
"You would have wasted a wish on that."
She and Issa were on the verge of breaking the bone between them, but they stopped.
"You're not a fool, Madrigal," Brimstone said. "If there's something you want, pursue it. Hope has power. Don't waste it on foolish things."
"Fine," she said, cupping the wishbone in her hand. "I'll save it until my hope meets your high expectations." She put it on a cord. For a few weeks, she made a point of voicing ridiculous wishes aloud and pretending to ponder them. "I wish I could taste with my feet like a butterfly. I wish scorpion mice could talk. I bet they know the best gossip. I wish my hair was blue." But she never broke the bone. What started as childish defiance turned into something else. Weeks became months, and the longer she went without breaking the wishbone,
the more important it seemed that when she did, the wish, the hope, rather, should be worthy of her. In the Requiem Grove with Akiva, it finally was. She formed her wish in her mind, looking him in the eyes, and pulled. The bone broke clean down the middle, and the pieces, when measured against each other, were of exactly the same length.
Oh, I don't know what that means. Maybe it means we both get our wishes.
Maybe it means that we wished for the same thing. Madrigal liked to think that it did. Her wish that first time was simple, focused, and passionate. That she would see him again. Believing she would was the only way she could bring herself to leave. They rose from their crushed clothes. Madrigal had to wriggle back into the midnight gown like a serpent back into a shed skin. They went into the temple and drank water from the sacred spring that rose in a fount from the earth. She splashed her face with it too, paid silent homage to a lie to protect their secret, and vowed to bring candles when she came again. Because of course she would come again. Parting was almost like a stage drama, an exaggerated physical impossibility. To fly away and leave Akiva there. The difficulty of which she would not, before this moment, have believed. She kept turning and returning for one last kiss. Her lips, unaccustomed to such wear, felt must and obvious, carnal. And she imagined herself red with the evidence of how she had spent her night. Finally she flew, trailing her mask by one of its long ribbon ties like a companion bird winging at her side. And the dawn-touched land rolled beneath her all the way back to Loramendi. The city lay quiet in the aftermath of celebration, pungent and hazy with a residue of fireworks. She went in by a secret passage to the underground cathedral. Its interlocking gates were keyed by Brimstone's magic to open to her voice, and there was no guard to see her come in. It was easy. That first day she was hesitant, cautious, not knowing what had passed in her absence, or what wrath might await her. But the fates were weaving their unguessable threads, and a spy came that morning from the Morea coast with news of Seraph galleons on the move, so that Thiago was gone from Loramendi almost as soon as Madrigal returned to it. Chiro asked her where she'd been, and she gave a vague lie. And from then on, her sister's manner toward her changed. Madrigal would catch her watching her with a strange flat effect, only to turn away and busy herself with something as if she hadn't been watching her at all. She saw her less, too, in part because Madrigal was adrift in her new and secret world, and in part because Brimstone had need of her help in that time. And so she was excused from her other duties, such as they were. Her battalion was not mobilized in response to the Seraph troop movements, and she thought, ironically, that she had Thiago to thank for it. She knew that he'd been keeping her from any potential danger that might relieve her of her purity before he had a chance to marry her. He must not have had time to countermand the orders before his departure. So Madrigal spent her days in the shop and cathedral with Brimstone, stringing teeth and conjuring bodies. And she spent her nights, as many as she could, with Akiva. She brought candles for Alai, and cones of frangible, the moon's favorite spice, and she smuggled out food fit for lovers, which they ate with their fingers after love. Honey sweets and sin berries, and roasted birds for their ravenous appetites, and always they remembered to take the wishbone from its place in the bird's breast. She brought wine in slender bottles and tiny cups carved from quartz to sip it from, which they rinsed in the sacred spring and stored in the temple altar for the next time. Over each wishbone, at each parting, they hoped for a next time. Madrigal often thought, as she sat quietly working in Brimstone's presence, that he knew what she was doing. His gold-green gaze would rest on her. And she would feel pierced, exposed, and tell herself that she couldn't go on as she was, that it was madness and she had to end it. Once she had even rehearsed what she was going to say to Akiva as she flew to the Requiem Grove. But as soon as she saw him, it went out of her mind, and she slipped without struggle into the luxury of joy, in the place they had come to think of as the world from her story, the paradise waiting for lovers to fill it with happiness. And they did fill it. For a month of stolen nights and the occasional sun-drenched afternoon when Madrigal could get away from Luramendi by day, they cupped their wings around their happiness and called it a world, though they both knew it was not a world, only a hiding place, which is a very different thing. After they had come together a handful of times and begun to learn each other in earnest, with the hunger of lovers to know everything, in talk and in touch, every memory and thought, every musk and murmur, when all shyness had left them, they admitted the future, that it existed, that they couldn't pretend it didn't. They both knew this wasn't a life, especially for Akiva, who saw no one but Madrigal and spent his days sleeping like the Evangelines and longing for night. Akiva confessed that he was the Emperor's bastard, one of a legion bred to kill, and he told her of the day the guards had come into the harem to take him from his mother, how she had turned away and let them, as if he wasn't her child at all, but only a tithe she had to pay, how he hated his father for breeding children to the task of death, and in flashes she could see that he blamed himself, too, for being one of them. Madrigal smoothed the raised scars on his knuckles and imagined the chimera represented by each line. She wondered how many of their souls had been gleaned and how many lost. She did not tell Akiva the secret of resurrection. When he asked why she bore no eye tattoos on her palms, she invented a lie. She couldn't tell him about revenants. It was too great a thing, too dire. The very fate of her race balanced upon it. And she couldn't share it, not even to assuage his guilt for all the chimera he had killed. Instead, she kissed his marks and told him, "War is all we've been taught, but there are other ways to live. We can find them, Akiva. We can invent them. This is the beginning. Here." She touched his chest and felt a rush of love for the heart that moved his blood, for his smooth skin and his scars and his unsoldierly tenderness. She took his hand and pressed it to her breast and said, "We are the beginning." They began to believe that they could be. Akiva told her that, in the 2 years since Bullfinch, he had not slain another chimera. "Is it true?" she asked, hardly believing it. "You showed me that one might choose not to kill." Madrigal looked down at her hands and confessed, "But I have killed Seraphim since that day." And Akiva took her chin and tilted her face up to his. "But in saving me, you changed me. And here we are because of that moment. Before, could you have thought it possible?" She shook her head. "Don't you think others could be changed, too?" "Some," she said, thinking of her comrades, friends. "The White Wolf." "Not all."
"Some, and then more."
"Some, and then more." Madrigal nodded, and together they imagined a different life, not just for themselves, but for all the races of Eretz. And in that month that they hid and loved, dreamed and planned, they believed that this, too, was meant, that they were the blossoms set forth by some great and mysterious intention, whether it was knitted or the god stars, or something else altogether they didn't know, only that a powerful will was alive in them to bring peace to their world. When they broke their wishbones now, that was what they hoped for.
They knew they couldn't hide in the Requiem Grove and daydream forever. There was work to be done. They were just beginning to make it real, with such passion in their hope that they might have wrought miracles, begun something. Had they not been betrayed?
Chapter 57 Revenant.
Akiva, breathed Karu, with the fullness of herself. Mere seconds had passed since they had broken the wishbone, but in that space of time, years had come home to her. 17 years ago, Madrigal had ended. All that had happened since was another life, but it was hers, too. She was Karu, and she was Madrigal. She was human and Chimera. She was Revenant. Within her, something was at work, a swift concrescence of memories, two consciousnesses that were really one, coming together like interlacing fingers. She saw her Hamsas and knew what Brimstone had done, in defiance of Thiago's sentence of evanescence. He had somehow gleaned her soul. And because she could not have a life in her own world, he had given her one here, in secret. How had he extracted her memory from her soul? The life she had lived as Madrigal. He had taken it all and put it in the wishbone, and saved it for her. It came to her what Ezeal had said the last time she saw him, when he offered her baby teeth, and she rejected them.
Once, he'd said,
and she hadn't believed him.
Once he wanted some.
She believed it now. Revenants were made for battle. Their bodies were always conjured fully grown, from mature teeth. But Brimstone had made her a baby, a human, named her Hope, and given her a whole life, far away from war and death. Sweet, deep, fond love filled her. He had given her a childhood, a world, wishes, art. And Issa and Yasri and Twiga, they had known and helped, hidden her, loved her. She would see them soon, and she wouldn't stand back from Brimstone as she always did, cowed by his gruffness and his monstrous physical presence. She would throw her arms around him and say, finally, thank you. She looked up from her palms, from one wonder to another, and Akiva was before her. He still stood at the foot of the bed, on which, just a moment earlier, they had fallen back together, all of him against all of her, and Karu understood that the aching allness rose from what she had shared with him in another body, another life. She had fallen in love with him twice. She loved him now with both loves, so overpowering it was almost unbearable. She beheld him through a prism of tears.
You escaped, she said. You lived.
She uncoiled from the bed, flashed toward him, threw herself against the remembered solidity of him, the heat. A hesitation. Then his arms came around her, tight. He didn't speak, but held her against him and rocked back and forth. She felt him shake, weeping, his lips pressed to the crown of her head.
You escaped, she repeated, sobbing, but laughing now too. You're alive. I'm alive, he whispered, choked. You're alive. I never knew. All these years, I never thought.
We're alive, Karu said, dazed. The wonder of it swelled within her, and she felt like their myth had come to life. They had a world. They were in it. This place that Brimstone had given her. It was half her home, and the other half lay waiting through a portal in the sky. They could have both, couldn't they?
I saw you die, Akiva said, helpless. Karu, Madrigal,
my love. His eyes, his expression, he looked as he had 17 years ago, on his knees, forced to watch. He said again, I saw you die. I know. She kissed him tenderly, remembering the scouring horror of his scream. I remember it all. As did he, the hooded executioner, a monster, the wolf and the warlord, looking on from their balcony, and the crowd, their stamping riot, their roars and bloodlust, monsters all, making a mockery of the dream of peace Akiva had nurtured since Bull Finch. Because one among them had touched his soul, he had believed them all worthy of that dream. And there she stood, in shackles, the one, his one, her wings in their pinion crimped cruelly out of shape, and the sham dream was gone. This was what they did to their own. His beautiful madrigal, graceful even now. He watched in helpless horror as she sank to her knees, laid her head on the block. Impossible, screamed Akiva's heart. This couldn't happen. The will, the mystery that had been on their side, where was it now? Madrigal's neck stretched vulnerable, her smooth cheek to the hot black rock, and the blade raised high and poised to fall. His scream was a thing. It clawed its way out of him, gutting him from the inside. It ripped and tore. There was pain. Pain to summon. And he tried to work it into magic. But he was too weak. The wolf had seen to that. Even now, Akiva was flanked by revenant guards, their hamsas aimed at him and flooding him with their debilitating sickness. Still he tried. And ripples went through the crowd as the very ground beneath their feet shifted. The scaffold rocked. The executioner had to take a step to steady himself, but it wasn't enough. The effort burst the blood vessels in his eyes. Still, he screamed. Tried. The blade glinted its descent, and Akiva fell forward on his hands. He was shredded. Empty. Love. Peace. Wonder. Gone. Hope. Humanity. Gone. All that remained was vengeance. The blade was a great and shining thing, like a falling moon. It bit, and Madrigal was unsheathed. She was aware of the falling away of flesh. She still was. She was, but she was not corporeal. She didn't want to see her head's disgraceful tumble, but couldn't help it. Her horns hit the platform first with a clatter, and then there was the ungodly thud of meat before it came to rest, the horns preventing it from rolling. From this strange new vantage point above her body, she saw it all. She couldn't not. The eyes had been the body's apparatus, with their selective focus and lids for closing. She had no such ability now. She saw everything, with no fleshly boundary to divide herself from the air all around her. It was a muted kind of seeing. All directions at once, as if her entire being were an eye, but a hazy one. The agora, the hateful crowd, and on the platform, facing her own, his scream still warping the air around her, Akiva on his knees, pitched forward and racked with sobs. Below her, she saw her own body, headless. It swayed to one side and collapsed. It was finished.
Madrigal felt tethered to it. She had expected that. She knew souls stayed with their bodies for several days before beginning to ebb. Revenants, who had been snatched back from the verge of evanescence, had said it felt like a tide carrying them out. Viago had ordered her body left on the platform to rot, under guard, so that no one might attempt to glean her soul. She was sorry for the treatment of her body. For all that Brimstone might call bodies envelopes, she loved the skin that had carried her through her life, and she wished it could have a more respectful end. But it couldn't be helped. And anyway, she didn't intend to be here to see it break down. She had other plans. She wasn't certain that it could be done, this idea she clung to. She had nothing but a hint to go on. But she wrapped all her will around it, and all her longing and passion, everything that she and Akiva had dreamed about, now thwarted, she directed into this one last act. She was going to set him free. To which end she would need a body. She had one picked out. It was a good one. She'd made it herself. She had even used diamonds. Chapter 58 Victory and Vengeance.
What's going on with you, Mad?
A week earlier, Madrigal had been with Chiro in the barracks. It was dawn, and she had crept into her bunk a mere half hour earlier from a night with Akiva.
What do you mean? Do you ever sleep anymore? Where were you last night?
Working, she said.
All night?
Yes, all night. Though I may have fallen asleep in the shop for a couple of hours. She yawned. She felt safe in her lies because no one outside Brimstone's inner circle knew what went on in the West Tower, or even knew about the secret passageway through which she came and went. And it was true that she had slept for a little while, just not in the shop. She dozed, curled against Akiva's chest, and woken to him watching her.
What?
She'd asked, bashful. Good dreams. You were smiling in your sleep.
Of course I was. I'm happy.
Happy. She thought that was what Chiro really meant when she asked, "What's going on with you?" Madrigal felt remade. She had never guessed how deep happiness could go. In spite of the tragedy in her childhood and the ever-present press of war, she had mostly considered herself happy. There was almost always something to take delight in, if you were trying. But this was different. It couldn't be contained. She sometimes imagined it streaming out of her like light. Happiness. It was the place where passion, with all its dazzling drumbeat, met something softer. Homecoming. And safety, and pure sunbeam comfort. It was all those things intertwined with the heat and the thrill, and it was as bright within her as a swallowed star. Her foster sister was scrutinizing her in silence when a trumpet blast in the city caused her to turn to the window. Madrigal went to her side and looked out. Their barracks were behind the armory, and they could just see the facade of the palace on the far side of the Agora, where the warlord's gonfalon hung, a vast silk banner that indicated he was in residence. It bore his heraldry, antlers sprouting leaves to signify new growth. And beside it, as Madrigal and Chiro watched, another gonfalon unfurled. This one was blazoned with a white wolf, and though it was too distant to read, they both knew its motto well. Victory and vengeance. Thiago had returned to Loramendi. Chiro's hands fluttered so that she had to steady them against the window ledge. Madrigal saw her sister's excitement, even as she fought her own rising bile. She had chosen to take Thiago's departure and absence as a sign of fate conspiring in her happiness. But if his absence had been a sign, what did his return signify?
The sight of his banner was like a splash of icy water. It couldn't douse her happiness, but it made her want to curl around it and protect it. She shivered. Chiru noticed.
What's the matter? Are you afraid of him?
Not afraid, Madrigal said. Only anxious that I gave offense, disappearing like I did. Her story had been that she drunk too much grass wine and, overcome by nerves, had hidden in the cathedral where she'd fallen asleep. She studied her sister's expression and asked,
Was he very angry? No one likes to be rejected, Mad.
She took that as a yes.
Do you think it's over now, though? That he's through with me? One way you could make sure, said Chiru.
She was glib, jesting, surely, but her eyes were bright.
You could die, she said. Resurrect ugly. He'd leave you alone then.
Madrigal should have known then to take care, at least. But she hadn't the soul for suspicion. Her trust was her undoing. Chapter 59 The World Remade. I can't save you. Brimstone. Madrigal looked up. She was on the floor in the corner of her barren prison cell and didn't expect saving.
I know.
He approached the bars and she held herself still, chin raised, face blank. Would he spit at her, as others had? He didn't have to. The simple fact of Brimstone's disappointment was worse than anything others could hurl at her.
Have they hurt you? He asked.
Only by hurting him. Which was worse a torture than she could have believed. Wherever they were keeping Akiva, it was just near enough that she could hear his screams when they crested into full agony. They rose, wavering audible at irregular intervals, so she never knew when the next one was coming, and had lived the past days in a state of sick expectancy. Brimstone studied her.
You love him.
She could only nod. She'd held up so well until now, high dignity and a hard veneer, not letting them see how inside she was dissolving, as if her evanescence had already begun. But under Brimstone's scrutiny, her lower lip began to tremble. She crushed her knuckles against it to still it. He was silent, and once she thought she could trust her voice, she said,
I'm sorry. For what, child?
Was he mocking her? His ovine face had always been impossible to read. Kishmish was on his horn, and the creature's posture mimicked his master's. The tilt of his head, the hunch of his shoulders. Brimstone asked,
Are you sorry for falling in love?
No, not for that.
Then what?
She didn't know what he wanted her to say. In the past, he had told her that all he ever wanted was the truth, as plain as she could make it. So what was the truth? What was she sorry for? For getting caught, she said, and for making you ashamed.
Should I be ashamed?
She blinked at him. She would never have believed that Brimstone would taunt her. She had thought he just wouldn't come. That her last sight of him would be on the palace balcony as he awaited her execution, along with everyone else. He said,
Tell me what it is you have done.
You know what I've done.
Tell me.
It was to be taunting, then. Madrigal bowed to it. She gave him a recitation. High treason. Consorting with the enemy. Endangering the perpetuity of the Chimera race and everything we've fought for 1,000 years. He cut her off.
I know your sentence. Tell me, in your own words.
She swallowed, trying to divine what he wanted. Haltingly, she said, I fell in love.
She shot him an abashed glance before revealing what she had so far told no one.
It started at the Battle of Bullfinch.
The fighting was over. It was after, during the gleaning. I found him dying, and I saved him. I didn't know why. It felt like the only thing. Later, I thought it was because we were meant for something.
Her voice dropped and her cheeks flamed as she whispered,
"To bring peace."
"Peace,"
Brimstone echoed.
How childish it seemed, considering where she was now, to have believed there was some divine intention in their love. And yet, how beautiful it had been. What she had shared with Akiva could not be touched by shame.
Madrigal lifted her voice to say, "We dream together of the world remade." There followed a long silence. Brimstone, just looking at her, and if she hadn't made a game of trying to outstare him as a child, she would have been ill-equipped to endure it. Even so, she was burning to blink by the time he finally spoke.
"And for that," he said, "I should be ashamed of you."
All the cogs of misery within Madrigal froze. It felt as if her blood stopped moving. She didn't hope. She didn't dare. What did he mean? Would he say more? No. He breathed a heavy sigh and said again,
"I can't save you."
I know.
"Yasri sent you these."
He thrust a cloth bundle through the bars and Madrigal took it. It was warm, fragrant. She unwrapped it and saw the horn-shaped pastries Yasri had been stuffing her with for years in a vain effort to fatten her up. Tears sprang to her eyes. She laid them gently aside. "I can't eat," she said. "But tell her I did."
"I will."
"And Issa and Twiga." An ache swelled in her throat. "Tell them." She had to press her knuckles to her lips again. She was barely holding it together. Why was it so much more difficult in Brimstone's presence? Before he came in, anger had kept her hard. Though she had yet to give him a message to relay, he said,
"They know, child. They already know. And they aren't ashamed of you either."
"Either?" It was as close as he would come, and it was good enough. Madrigal burst into tears. She leaned into the bars, head down, and wept, and she felt his hand settle on her neck and wept harder. He stayed with her, and she knew that no one but Brimstone, save the warlord himself, could have overridden Thiago's direct order that she have no visitors. He had power, but even he couldn't overrule her sentence. Her crime was just too grave, her guilt too plain. After she had cried, she felt at once hollow and better, as if the salt of all her unshed tears had been poisoning her, and now she was cleansed. She leaned against the bars. Brimstone was hunkered down on the other side. Kishmish started chirping regular little snips that Madrigal knew were a combination boss-beg, so she broke off bits of Yasri's pastry and fed them to him. "Prison picnic," she said with a weak effort at a smile, which then bit off abruptly. They both heard it at the same time. A scream of such pure wretchedness that Madrigal had to fold over herself, press her face to her knees, and her hands to her ears, pitching herself in darkness, silence, denial. It didn't work. This fresh scream was already in her skull, and even after it stopped, its echo stayed inside her.
Who will be first?
She asked Brimstone. He knew what she meant.
You. With the Seraph watching.
In a moment of strange detachment, she said, I thought he would decide the opposite and make me watch.
I believe, said Brimstone with some hesitation, that he isn't finished with him yet.
A small sound escaped Madrigal's throat. How long? How long would Iago make him suffer? She asked Brimstone, Do you remember the wishbone? When I was younger?
I remember.
I finally made a wish on it. Or a hope, I suppose, as there was no real magic in it.
Hope is the real magic, child.
Images flashed through her mind. Akiva smiling his smile of light. Akiva beaten to the ground, his blood running into the sacred spring. The temple in flames as the soldiers dragged them away. The requiem trees starting to catch fire, too, and all the evangelines that lived in them. She reached into her pocket and produced the wishbone she had brought to the grove that last time. It was intact. They had never gotten the chance to break it. She thrust it at Brimstone. Here, take it, trample it, throw it away. There is no hope.
If I believed that,
Brimstone said,
I wouldn't be here now.
What did that mean?
What do I do, child? Day after day, but fight against a tide. Wave after wave upon the shore. Each wave licking farther up the sand. We won't win, Madrigal. We can't beat the Seraphim.
What? But
we can't win this war. I've always known it. They are too strong. The only reason we've held them off this long is because we burned the library.
The library?
Of Astray. It was the archive of the Seraph Magi. The fools kept all their texts in one place. They were so jealous of their power, they didn't allow copies. They didn't want any upstarts to challenge them. So they hoarded their knowledge, and they took only apprentices they could control, and kept them close. That was their first mistake. Keeping all their power in one place.
Madrigal listened, rapt. Brimstone telling her things. History. Secrets. Almost afraid to break the spell, she asked, What was their next mistake?
Forgetting to fear us.
He was silent a moment. Kishmish hopped back and forth from one of his horns to the other.
They needed to believe we were animals. To justify the way they used us.
Slaves, she whispered, hearing Issa's voice in her head.
We were pain trolls. We were the source of their power.
Torture.
They told themselves we were dumb beasts, as if that made it all right. They had 5,000 beasts in their pits. Who weren't dumb at all. But they believed their own fiction. They didn't fear us. And that made it easy.
Made what easy?
Destroying them. Half the guards didn't even understand our language. Were happy to believe it was just grunts and roars we screamed in our agony. They were fools. And we killed them. And we burned everything. Without magic, the Seraphim lost their supremacy, and all these years, they have not recovered it. but they will. Even without the library. Your Seraph is proof that they are rediscovering what they lost.
But no, Akiva's magic, it isn't like that. She thought of the living shawl he'd made her. He would never use it as a weapon. He only wanted peace.
Magic isn't a tool of peace. The price is too high. The only way I can keep using it, cycling souls through death after death, is by believing that we are keeping alive until the world can be remade.
Her words. He cleared his throat. It sounded like gravel churning. Was it possible? Was he telling her that he...
He said, I dream it too, child.
Madrigal stared.
Magic won't save us. The power it would take to conjure on such a scale. The tithe would destroy us. The only hope is hope.
He still held the wishbone.
You don't need tokens for it. It's in your heart, or nowhere. And in your heart, child, it has been stronger than I have ever seen.
He slipped the bone into his breast pocket, then rose from his lion-haunched crouch and turned. Madrigal's heart cried out at the thought that he was leaving her alone, but he only paced to the small window on the far wall and looked out.
It was Chiro, you know,
he said in an abrupt change of subject. Madrigal knew. Chiro, who had the wings to follow her, and who hid in the grove, and saw. Chiro, who, like Thiago's lapdog, betrayed her for a pat on the head.
Thiago promised her human aspect,
Brimstone said,
as if it were a promise he could keep.
Stupid Chiro, thought Madrigal. If that was her hope, she had chosen her alliance poorly. You won't honor his promise? With a dark look, Brimstone replied,
she should make best efforts to never need another body. I have a string of moray eel teeth I never thought I would be tempted to use.
Moray eel? Madrigal couldn't tell if he was serious. Probably. She felt almost sorry for her sister. Almost. To think, I wasted diamonds on her.
You were true to her, even if she was not to you. Never repent of your own goodness, child. To stay true in the face of evil is a feat of strength.
Strength, she said with a little laugh. I gave her strength. And look what she did with it.
He scoffed. Chiro is not strong. Her body may have been wrought with diamonds, but her soul within will be a soft mollusk thing, wet and shrinking.
It was an unlovely image, but it felt just about right. Brimstone added,
and easily pushed aside.
Madrigal cocked her head. What? Out in the corridor, sounds. Was someone coming? Was it time? Brimstone spun toward her.
The revenant smoke, he said, quick and clipped. You know what is in it.
She blinked. Why was he talking about the smoke? There would be none of it for her. But he was looking at her so intently. She nodded. Of course she knew. The incense was arum and feverfew. Rosemary
and Asa fed it a resin for the sulfur smell.
You know why it works, he said.